The other thing that I tend to see, you know, is that today a lot of designers don't specify the PCBs correctly. You know, they quote IPC or, you know, a standard or a reference, but they don't understand the standard. So they'll say, I want this to IPC XYZ, but they've never read the standard. Or if they specify something to a PCB manufacturer, they've never read those standards. So a better understanding of what you're buying is important, and how you specify it, I think, is important. And that would eliminate many of the problems we see within the industry.
That's my guest, Bob Willis, next on Reliability Matters.
Welcome to Reliability Matters, a podcast for the electronic assembly industry. Each episode covers topics related to reliability, best practices, and environmentally responsible assembly techniques, with insights from experts across the electronic assembly industry. Now, here's your host, Mike Conrad.
Welcome to episode one of Reliability Matters, a podcast dedicated to the subject of reliability of circuit assemblies. I'll be your host, Mike Conrad. When it comes to electronic assemblies, reliability has never been more important than it is today. In an era of Internet of Things, or IoT, including wearables, Industry 4.0, implantables, automotive, we're surrounded with electronic assemblies. In fact, electronics are ubiquitous. They are everywhere. Cisco predicts there'll be over 50 billion connected devices within the next few short years. Many of these connected devices will be functioning in harsh environments. In the case of automotive electronics, reliability plays a key safety role. Not that long ago, if an electronic assembly failed within an automobile, the result may be that the car wouldn't start or the radio wouldn't play. Today, if failure occurs in an automobile's circuit assembly, the car might suddenly accelerate or steer off the road or into another car. The reliability of circuit assemblies is more important, and it is more frequently a life or death matter. My goal with this podcast is to share information on reliability best practices. While my experience comes from the cleaning segment of circuit assembly production, reliability extends far beyond assembly contamination. For the past several years, I've been producing technical reliability-based workshops. During these workshops, I've collaborated with many experts in the fields of placement, reflow, AOI, X-ray, and many more. My goal is to bring these process experts together to discuss reliability best practices within their fields of expertise. Okay, a little bit about me. I began my career in the electronic assembly equipment industry in 1985 as a manufacturer of drag soldering machines. In 1989, the U.S. government and 11 other nations at that time announced a prohibition of specific CFC-based chemicals. These included chemicals that were commonly used to clean circuit assemblies. While the ban on cleaning solvents eventually inspired the invention of no-clean flux, there remained a need to clean by at least some assemblers. I designed a water-based cleaning system that did not require the use of a banned chemical. In 1992, I founded Aqueous Technologies, a manufacturer of automated cleaning systems for circuit assemblies as well as ionic contamination testing equipment. Today, I travel the world attending electronic assembly conferences, presenting papers, webinars, and workshops on the subject of reliability in electronics. Adding to this effort is this podcast. I intend to produce 24 episodes this year, two per month, released on the second and fourth Tuesdays of each month. The Reliability Matters podcast is available on iTunes and Spotify, as well as on aqueoustech.com and spreaker.com. I'm thrilled to introduce my first guest on this debut episode of Reliability Matters. Bob Willis operates a training and consultancy business based in England. Bob is a member of the SMTA Group Technical Committee. Bob was chairman of the SMART Group, now known as SMTA Europe, from 1990 to 1994. He was elected honorary president for life. We'll have to ask him about that. Bob has provided training and consultancy in most areas of the electronic manufacturing industry for over 30 years. You may have seen Bob teach courses at any number of trade shows in any number of countries, or perhaps you've seen his instructional videos online. Hello, Bob.
Hi, good afternoon to you.
Well, good afternoon. Good morning to me. Good afternoon to you. We are separated by 6,000 miles on this podcast. Normally, I'm used to seeing you on a trade show floor, teaching your courses or watching you on my laptop screen. This is an unusual experience to be able to talk to you and not actually see you right in front of me. I don't know. For you, that might be better. For me, I don't know. But I'm glad to be talking with you right now. And thanks for being part of this this first episode. How'd you get into this consultancy business, Bob?
Well, I guess, I've been running my own training consultancy business for over 30 years. Originally, I worked at GC Marconi, and I was involved in, manufacturing, PCB fabrication, failure analysis, environmental test. And then I joined a contract manufacturing company for a few years, PCB Fab as well. And the company was going to be taken over by another organization. And I thought, well, I might as well just do my own thing, which I did. So consequently, I've been doing this for that amount of time, sort of over 30 years. I got into training originally through kind of default. On a Friday afternoon, there wasn't a lot going on in manufacturing, clean down for the weekend or the maintenance shift. And I started running little training courses for groups of engineers and operators on the floor. It wasn't my job, and I got told off a few times, but to me, it seemed like a logical thing to do. And provided the people concerned wanted to hear something which was related to the business, that's how I got into training, and I've been doing it ever since. If you like what you do, if you enjoy passing on information, then I guess you might as well make a business out of it.
Well, what's the saying? If you love what you do, you never work a day in your life. So it sounds like you were training's in your blood. You were doing training when you were, whether it was official training or licensed training or not, you were doing training when you were at Marconi. Now that you're on your own and you've been on your own for 3 decades. What types of services do you offer?
I guess that the majority of it is training and more online training now. I prefer to do that sort of thing because, in all honesty, it's a lot cheaper for the customer. When you look at the cost of travel and accommodation, and then you compare it with the actual cost of your man hours, all that cost is really wasted. So if you can spend more time providing online, and I still create a lot of video content, which you can do with webinars if you prepare them correctly. So a lot of what I do can be done from my desktop as we're doing this, having this conversation. And, I've done it for SMTA in the past where I've done sort of 2-hour presentations for different chapters. And I've seen the other side. I've seen the recordings of the videos there. One was at a golf course. I always remember seeing the lady bringing around the cakes in the afternoon for the break, and I'm still talking. And it was a weird sensation. So that sort of media is fabulous for me. I like to travel, but if I can impart information at a realistic timescale and cost, then that's got to be much more beneficial to customers. It's nice to be one-to-one with people or as a group, but I just think, why are we spending all this money traveling when we could do it in other ways?
Yeah, I find in our business that webinars and online activities are much more focused when we're at a customer site in person. Lots of customers want to take you in every different direction at the same time, and sometimes we lose the focus and the organization. So these types of activities tend to be a little bit more on the agenda. Although it must be terrible to see golfers in the background knowing you can't pull out your gloves and take a swing. That's probably the downside of virtual training as opposed to on-site training.
Plus, when I was mm-hmm. a kid, my mother and father were a steward and stewardess of a quite a big golf club in the Essex area where I live. So I could play anytime. I had the best clubs anybody could have because I got the leftovers, the ones that were left lying around. I knew instinctively, because I was a caddy, to raise pocket money where all the bowls were lost. It was just easy for me. So really, I don't really have that much interest in golf because of those early years.
There you go. You got it out of your system early. I'm a late golfer, so I think it won't leave my system probably until I'm in the ground. So in my business, and I'm sure in other businesses, we see problems come in themes. We see 10 people unrelated all contact us with a similar issue. Do you see that in your business? Do you see common themes of say failures or questions? And if so, what's the theme of the day?
I think it's everything you've ever heard about, everything you've seen before just keeps going round and round and round. I mean, just literally today I had two people, one PCB fabricator and one assembler, in the UK, contact me about a problem, send some pretty pictures. And I said, okay, that's the reason. That's the reason. But the problem is sometimes you're talking about the same product. So I have got into that situation a couple of times now where I'm telling, you know, the same story to two parties. But unfortunately they're then talking to each other. It doesn't bother to me. I'm being honest about what I say. But sometimes if you're working for a company, you know, a commercial company, if you're already contracted, you can't talk to somebody else. So that's a sort of a weird thing that can happen. And it's one of those things I'm sure other people come up against. If we talk about sort of process defects, I still see so many process defects associated with surface finish on PCBs. That's still, you know, very, very common. It always reminds me of the one of the videos I made back when I was making videos. I introduced a video on a guide to surface finishes, and it was my worst selling video. And although that particular problem has just gone on and on and on for years, it's really weird. The other thing that I tend to see, you know, is that today a lot of designers don't specify the PCBs correctly. You know, they quote IPC or, you know, a standard or a reference, but they don't understand the standard. So they'll say, I want this to IPC XYZ, but they've never read the standard. Or if they specify something to a PCB manufacturer, they've never read those standards. So a better understanding of what you're buying is important, and how you specify it, I think, is important. And that would eliminate many of the problems we see within the industry.
Yeah, we see similar things. We see an OEM will decide to send a contract manufacturer a job, and suddenly they start pulling out all these IPC standards that were never really in effect or utilized while the product was manufactured by the OEM. But as soon as it goes down to the CM, all of a sudden all these standards get thrown at them. We see that in the cleaning industry a lot. You know, they want it clean to XYZ or whatever. So yeah, it is interesting as the product gets further away from the OEM, more standards get thrown at them at the CM level.
Well, the other thing that happens also, and I've had this quite a lot of occasions, where you've got contract manufacturers, because effectively, if it's a contract manufacturer that's got different sites, you know, they're always competing for the business. And sometimes you get, well, you're not manufacturing it to the correct standard, but we're talking to the site next door or the site in another country. But it's the same as OEMs. OEMs can produce products sometimes, and they've got other sites in other countries. And then they argue themselves about the quality standards, which is, you know, it's crazy, but they're all still competing for the business internally.
Sure. It's like little site. They silo their operations and don't speak to each other and work off different standards. So in my business, you know, Maslow said, if all you have is a hammer, you see everything as a bed of nails. And in my world, in cleaning, we see everything as a contamination problem, which may or may not be true. As circuit assemblies and the components mounted on them are increasingly smaller in size, and that results in extremely high component densities, very low standoff heights, if there's any standoff height at all. How has miniaturization, not just from a contamination standpoint, but from other manufacturing standpoints affected reliability, if you think it has?
Well, if we start off with the cleaning, because that's obviously close to your heart, first of all, you know, obviously standoff heights has impacted the ability to clean, the ability to measure, and the ability to detect whether you've got a reliable product or not. And, you know, I'm always the nuts and bolts guy. I like to see something. I like to do something to see whether it's actually working. So simple tests wherever possible to see that a board is being cleaned, the machine is cleaning a board effectively, and also we can actually test under it if we're using, you know, Rose testing. So, you know, what is the capability of those things? And an engineer doesn't have to spend a fortune doing those sort of tests. And he needs to do that, first of all, before he then embarks on the far more expensive tests of doing SIR and other analysis like ion chromatography. I find some engineers jump in right at the start and find they haven't got a good result because they haven't optimized their process. So why waste money? Get the simple things done, first of all, and then move on to the qualification test, which the customer and, of course, others want to see. If we look at low standoff devices, I guess over the last sort of 5 to 10 years, QFNs, you know, we've seen them being introduced on pretty much any product. They're produced in that style because they're cheap to produce. You can put lots of different functionality in them, and you can get pretty good yields. If we move and forget about voiding for a moment, which many occasions is just not relevant because most of the people using these devices don't need the heat dissipation factors that they think they need. So everybody gets drawn into, you know, we need 20%, we need 10%. I've worked in companies for a couple of days trying to solve a problem when I found, when I talked to the designer, it didn't matter. They didn't even need to have solder underneath this part. And I'm trying to solve voids for them. Absolutely crazy. But moving on just back to QFNs as well, QFN 40s are a package which, you know, are quite popular. But then companies, automotive companies, high reliability companies have moved on to bigger packages. And to me, it seems strange that they've just forgotten everything they learnt with large surface mount devices, that we have a problem of expansion and contraction between the substrate and the component and the solder joint. And we can all perhaps use a different solder, but fundamentally, if one thing expands at a greater rate than the other and contracts at a different rate, then you're going to have problems. So going from a small QFN, going to a 100-pin QFN, people started to see failures. And it to me, just seems illogical. But then again, you know, I've grown up in a generation, you know, I'm getting old now. The younger engineers perhaps haven't experienced some of the problems that we've seen in the past. So QFNs and standoff heights and cleanliness and these sort of things are still popular problems that we see and discuss widely.
Yeah, I was just at the cleaning and coating conference in Chicago last week, and there was a lot of talk about these bottom terminated components. And what's interesting is there seems to be a complete disconnect between the component manufacturers and the OEMs and contract manufacturers that use them. The component manufacturers come up with a package that has a lot of attributes in itself, but the whole concept of design for manufacturability is just out the window. So component manufacturers come up with a package, and then there are years of conferences devoted to how to utilize those packages and how to mount those packages and how to solder large packages with more than 2,000 connections below them onto an assembly. It seems that the component manufacturers and the technology to utilize those components are on different planets. And it takes time for the industry to catch up with the technology. And by the time they do, of course, then the latest terrible package comes out that can't be used. And we have to figure out how to use it. It's kind of the cart before the horse, or so it seems from this end.
Well, it's the same as lead-free technology. You know, if you think about for the last 12 years or so, we've been talking about this technology. It's, you know, a lot of engineers have spent thousands of pounds attending conferences when, you know, really there hasn't been a benefit at all. It's cost the industry more. Some of the materials are more hazardous, more difficult to generate. The cost has gone up tremendously. So there are certain groups of countries in certain parts of the world have got a lot to answer for.
Yeah, agreed. So let's talk about harsh environments for a moment. I was in Amsterdam earlier this year at the Harsh Environment Conference. At the Cleaning and Clothing Conference last week in Chicago, there was a lot of talk about harsh environments. And I have a maybe what might be a unique view on harsh environments. So traditionally, we defined harsh environments as like downhole in Houston in an oil field, or up in space, or an unpressurized part of an aircraft, or any other uninhabitable environment. Do you see a redefinition of harsh environments? And if so, has miniaturization or other factors moved the bar into what's considered a harsh environment?
I think it's an interesting question. I think that certainly if you talked about harsh environments, as you so rightly said, you know, downhole drill, a really demanding environment. If you look at space applications, there's different applications in space. And, you know, I've worked for a couple of satellite manufacturers and, you know, went into the conversation with them, you know, talking about the harsh environment, said, no, it's an office environment in certain applications. So you've got to be specific. And I'm not saying that you need to be specific. I'm just saying we need to be specific about, you know, what space applications. If we look at, you know, the things that are coming along, you know, really, electric cars and those sort of applications are really going to be demanding, not because they're necessarily working in a harsh environment, but the amount of voltage and current that those cars are going to be utilizing, and the battery technology, you know, what we're having to do in terms of board technology to meet those requirements and test those requirements in the future. We were doing a webinar with MPL literally yesterday, and I was quite intrigued looking at one of the slides showing the protective environment that all of the electronics has to sit in, with, you know, sort of safety cutouts and laser cutouts and all this sort of stuff. The test equipment sat outside, but all of the sort of the gubbins were sitting in this box, taking up probably more test area room than anything else. But, you know, because we're talking about these huge voltages and currents, so that's sort of a demanding environment. If you look at, you know, wind farms and turbines, you know, some of the printed circuit boards in those obviously see potentially very high temperatures, a lot of vibration. And if they're not designed properly, then, you know, they can be at serious risk. So there's lots of things that can be defined. But I think, you know, more and more automotive are going to move into that because of the revolution in the electric car.
Sure. I'm going to get into this a little bit more in a second, but in the case of wearables, for example, most wearables are treated as a harsh environment product because wearables go on people. People tend to go into harsh environments, not necessarily downhole or space, but cold, hot, humid, vibration, all those things that are traditionally attributes of check marks of harsh environment. So, you know, I think as boards become smaller, the tolerance for, in this case, residues, since that's my specialty, is lower. And as the residue tolerance lowers due to board design, the threshold for what is a harsh environment / safe environment is variable. That's one of the themes of the conference I was at last week was, you know, what is a harsh environment and do we have to build to it? And if we think we're not going down an oil well, so we don't need to build for harsh environment. That may be kind of flawed logic with the way boards are designed today. You know, I've noticed over the past one or two decades that many OEMs and contract manufacturers alike have seen their company sages, the wise men, the wise women, retire. These were people who had been around for many years, were very knowledgeable in a wide variety of electronic manufacturing disciplines. They were like Bob Willises all over. Everyone had their Bob Willis working for them. And they knew where all the process skeletons were buried. So many process experts left. As many of them left, so did their expertise and their tribal knowledge. Many were never replaced. In fact, it's very rare now. Maybe in a large company, I see a process expert or a wide experienced process expert. But most of them were never replaced, and they left behind this huge knowledge gap, which unfortunately get replaced by product salesmen, you know, trying to sell their wares. Do you agree with this assessment? And if so, what do we do about it?
Well, I totally agree. You find that obviously some of those people just don't want to do it anymore. You know, I know of three or four people I know within the industry who have written books and are very well known, if I mention the names, but they just said, no, I don't want to do it anymore. I've finished. I've been there, done that, and I just don't want to do it. But there are people that do want to continue, you know, helping, being a role model for other engineers. And I think that if you think about it, with as an example of we have B&Q as a department store over here, which sells, you know, everything related to building stuff, paint, etc.
And that would be our, you know, equivalent of Home Depot, right? That's like our Home Depot, same thing.
And, you know, those guys have got common sense to hire people in the prime of their life, not old people, but prime of their life. And those guys have been there, done it. So, you know, the tricks of the trade, you know, how to prepare a surface for painting, gluing, whatever. So, you know, perhaps a lot of these contract manufacturers, and that's no disrespect to the younger engineers, but a lot of these guys could hire people and have them on call to help out with different problems. And I think a lot of older engineers, you know, would enjoy the extra, you know, money, obviously, but we just enjoy working again in manufacture. Again, not everybody, but that's something I would, you know, like to do. But I'd like to do it more from my desk because I think I can be more productive than going on the shop floor. But I was on the shop floor last week for 2 days building 150 boards. At the start of that week, I was helping a company, with a wire loom problem. So sort of even going back even further in my youth. So, you know, I like that sort of problem solving. I like helping people and obviously education, but, the younger engineers with, again, no disrespect, tend to love the toys. So if you've got a production line, and you've implemented, you know, let's say AOI, SPI, you know, all the sort of inspection equipment, that's fine. And they are doing a job and doing it perhaps more effectively than, you know, some operators because they can look at boards faster. But the bottom line is younger engineers don't tend to look at boards. They think the machine tells everything. It doesn't. If you've got a problem on a board, whether it's misplaced components, poor soldering, whatever, the machine has told you that it's got a problem. It's told you how many problems it's got, and it's passed on the corrective actions to whatever other machines. But somebody's got to look at the boards occasionally. And I worked in units in Italy once, and I said to the engineers, have you looked at the boards? Oh, no, we don't go on the shop floor. I said, you're an engineer and you're responsible for the reflow and the white. No, that's the technician's job. So how can you solve problems if you never go on the shop floor? Crazy. So it's attitudes, I think, as much as anything.
You know, I'm a licensed pilot. And when I was going through my training, the flight instructor kept drilling into me, fly the plane. And I'm like, well, duh, of course I fly the plane. But I've like to read these NTSB reports of plane crashes and several of them have been because the pilots really stopped flying the plane. They were so reliant on instruments and automation that the old fashioned stick and rudder, which is what you're speaking about in the electronic manufacturing business, is put to the side, and they assume that the auto throttle is set, or the, you know, automatic glide slope approach is set, whatever. They think that's all set. And, you know, there was a major airline that crashed in San Francisco a few years ago, just short of the runway, because they had four licensed pilots in the cockpit at the time they landed, and no one realized that one button wasn't pushed, and they just relied on the automation. And I guess that's, you know, kind of a scary analogy, but it drives home the point. In any industry, you can't stop flying the plane. If you're building boards, you can't stop looking at the boards. If you're driving a car, you can't rely on, you know, the Tesla autopilot, you know, to not see the semi truck in the middle of the road. You have to constantly be involved with your process and own your process. I guess that applies to any industry, specifically this one.
Well, two years ago, I was working with a company, and they were looking at conformal coating, and they were looking at cleanliness and doing SIR testing. And I said, well, that's great. You've got the results. You can see there's a problem with those results, but did you look at the boards? So why would we look at the boards? Well, I said, you've got the results. You've got the squiggly lines, which represent the SIR trace. You can see when it's changed. Did you look at the boards? Well, you know, why? Because you've got to see where the failure occurred. Yes, you can look at all this sort of technical stuff, and I do as well, but I want to see where the failures occur. I also want to try and understand why they've occurred. And this particular company was a solder paste manufacturer. And then sort of the next year at this conference, I had five of their development guys on a training course with me, specifically on this sort of subject. And I thought, okay, that obviously worked. But it, to me, you've got to drill down and look at the detail. You may not want to, but you've got to see what's actually happening before you can actually fix a problem. And if you can do that, it's easier to fix a problem.
Yeah, very true. So with Internet of Things, IoT, fueling the electronic assembly industry with potentially billions of new devices. In fact, Cisco stated not long ago that in the next few years, they expect there to be up to 75 billion new connected devices. Many of these devices will be highly miniaturized and will operate in relatively harsh environments. Is our industry prepared for the next major evolution?
Well, first of all, can I just say one thing, and I may upset people, but I'm bored to death with 4.0 Internet of Things, because, you know, it's marketing speak for what is happening in the industry. And obviously somebody came up with these two things and have run conferences on the subject and obviously made some money, which is great. But if we drill down to the detail, you know, communicating with machines, communicating information between machines and people, you know, those are sort of things we should be doing in the first place. It's not rocket science. So I do get upset when people jump on bandwagons and use these phrases. But going on to the question you asked, I just had to say that.
Get it off your chest, Bob. Get it off your chest.
Yeah. Whether anybody will notice, I don't know. But I think that we have to take on board that, you know, technology, you mentioned about wearables, an example, you know, whatever type of technology, we've got to put the effort and time into testing and evaluation, setting standards. I mean, in MPL's work with wearable technology, we spent a lot of time with washing machines. We've got a particular type of fabric which we can integrate into wearable. And, you know, I turned up one day and there's this washing machine. I said, what's that there for? Just a standard pucker washing machine. And again, it's for testing. And then that will allow us to do some sort of standards, which then can be used in the industry. So we just got to adapt what we do. But I think we still got to use the basis of what we do and do reasonably well, which is perhaps MPI. So we've got to look at how we do that and how we adapt it to the newer technologies. And one of the things that tends to get forgotten about, and this is not just with sort of, you know, current technology, over the last, I would say, 20 or so years, we've done far less testing, environmental testing of products. I know the time to market is very, very short, but we still must do some testing. And I see a lot of products that are quite often introduced, unless they need to be tested, they're not tested. And I've seen something close to your heart, contamination failures, because people have said, okay, I have not been asked to do any testing. I won't do any testing, but I know condensation is going to form on this display on this automotive application. Come on.
Yeah, I'm a huge proponent of environmental testing. That all other forms of testing are predictive, and environmental is a reality-based test. It basically accelerates the age. You get into this time machine, go 5 years into the future and see what, if your board is still alive. All other tests, particularly contamination testing, ROSE testing, SIR, even ion chromatography, they give you numbers. They give you factor points, but they don't predict whether those numbers will cause a failure. The only thing that really predicts that is an environmental test, steam age testing, et cetera. Put the board under stress with a bias in an oven with a bunch of humidity, and it's like a DeLorean time machine. You know, it's really the only way, that surefire way anyway, that we can predict with any level of accuracy the reliability of a board into the future. Everything else is just based on experiences with other boards, which are probably a different design, probably less dense, et cetera. But the time to market is a big thing. And I was involved a few years ago. I was hired as an expert witness in a litigation matter where an OEM was suing a contract manufacturer because they did exactly what the OEM wanted. And the OEM's point was, you should have known better. And these were boards that were 50,000 boards that were installed in various parts of North America that were running on a battery, and best practices weren't followed by any means. And the batteries within a few months started to fail. The 10-year batteries started to fail. If they had done some type of accelerated aging tests or environmental stress tests, they would have seen that right away, and they would have saved millions of dollars in recalling 50,000 devices and fixing them. That is an industry trend, unfortunately. And I think the problem in electronics is we're one of the few industries where the products we produce are expected by the public to be half the size, cost half as much, last twice as long year over year over year. It's kind of a race to the bottom. And a lot of companies, particularly in the consumer industry, not so much class three, that where it's going into an aircraft or a rocket or whatever, but particularly class one and class two electronics, it's a race to the bottom in terms of profitability, and anything that can be cut out is cut out. And that includes the environmental tests that you're referring to.
But if we take that as a logical, way forward, I've been in situations once where somebody wanted to evaluate, a liquid flux on a board. And I said, well, we should do some environmental tests. And they said, no, we haven't got the money. I said, well, have we got some time? And they said, yeah. Okay. I said, okay, well, we'll take the five products. We'll just leave them out in the rain. just do something. If you do nothing, that's bad. If you do something, at least you've learned something. And we could see corrosion products on two of the products. So, I mean, even if you were doing simple sorting out five materials and threw away three because you can instantly see corrosion, I mean, that's got to be of some value to shorten the path to use. I mean, I love to do simple tests that show something happening, show some failure or prove a point. I can then go back and spend some money with a laboratory doing the fancy tests. But let's try and think of things we can do quickly, which don't cost too much, but can be done quickly, rather than taking a week to come up with a report which says, okay, you've got contamination there and it could be this.
Right.
Personal opinion.
Yeah, well, that makes a lot of sense. I'm going to paraphrase a common statement. The common statement is, we don't have time to do it right, but we'll find time to do it over. I might say, we don't have the money to do it right, but we have the money to hire Bob Willis to tell us to do it right. So it's, you're going to pay the money or spend the time one way or the other. So might as well do it right the first time. But I think you have a lot of job security, Bob. I don't think the need for you or people like you are going to go away anytime soon. And what keeps you up at night with regard to the electronic industry? Is there anything, any trends or technologies that kind of keep you up at night?
honestly don't think so. I mean, you know, if something new comes along, you know, I really get quite excited by it. I mean, obviously the last thing was package-on-package technology. I know that's been in mobile phones now for probably 5 or 6 years, the first one being Nokia with the lipstick phone, which was the most hideous phone ever invented. But, you know, it used the technology. And I, you know, when I started, I couldn't afford the components because they were so expensive to buy from the well-known component suppliers. So I made my own, and people said, well, you know, they're not the same size. The ball pitch is a different size. I said, it doesn't matter. I am learning. I'm putting one package on top of another. I'm soldering them in place. I will learn about dip paste. I will learn about profiling. I will learn about cleaning. I'll learn all this stuff. And then when I can afford to buy some smaller ones, some cheaper ones, I will learn again. But, you know, that was, you know, great. I really enjoyed that. When we talk about waking up early or keeping me up, it's happened just recently. I was, again, building some boards for a customer, 150, and there were two different styles of boards. And I can distinctly remember I woke up, I mean, about 3 o'clock in the morning, I'd forgotten something. I got a list of all the things I needed to, and I'd forgotten something. So that made me jump up. And occasionally, if I'm doing production lines, I know that you've been involved with me once at Productronica doing my cleaning and contamination center a few years back. You know, I can get everything written down. I can plan everything. And then sometimes I think, oh, I've forgotten something. So it's those types of things that tend to wake me up at night rather than sort of technology. It's making sure I've put everything in place for something I'm going to do.
Very good. We're going to have to wrap this up. We're running short of time, but I want to ask one more question. And this is something that you arguably cannot do from your desktop as much as you would like to. What's your favorite dive location? I know you're an avid diver. I've seen all the pictures.
To be perfectly honest, out of anywhere I've ever dived, I have to say Little Cayman. So
is that,
I've been to the...
Is that near Grand... Is that part of Grand Cayman?
Yeah. Yeah, there's Cayman Brac, Little Cayman, and, you know, obviously the main Cayman Islands. But, you know, there it's unspoiled. You've got some great diving. You've got some nice beaches to walk along. You've got this one little sort of – it's like an oldie worldie, and I no disrespect to the restaurant itself. It's like an oldie worldie sort of cafe, American type cafe, diner. And, you know, we'd eat in there most nights and have very good food, just basic good food. And I'd take a bottle of wine, go back to our little bungalow on the beach. Just idyllic. And although I, you know, have been to lots of different locations, that's the sort of, I just would go back there as a drop of a hat. And the diving's good as well.
But it helps that the water's warm. You probably wear like a 2 mil shorty or something, right? You don't have to wear that 7 mil, you know, almost like a diving bell. You know, the water's nice and warm, at least most times of the year. I've had some good dives in Grand Cayman. I haven't done Little Cayman. I've done Jamaica. Jamaica's nice, but the coral is all wrecked. You know, it's been picked at over all the years. I've done Turks and Caicos, but kind of the same thing. Not a lot of coral. But I have heard great things about the Cayman Islands and also the Great Barrier Reef. Ever gone there? Ever dived
yes,
there?
Yes. Yeah. I dived there. And this is quite a few years ago. I used to go over there and work for the, what was and what has become Australian SMTA. I used to work for those guys, a few years back, and, myself and, Zaro were over there a couple of times, but we've never actually dived together because he's a diver as well. So I didn't really enjoy it as much. And of course you've had all the bleaching over there of the coral as well. It's been a lot of that's been devastated as well. Little Cayman, you know, number one, everybody should go there, or you can always obviously watch the Cayman video clip on my YouTube channel.
There you go. Well, if no one got anything out of this podcast except one thing, that one thing might be Little Cayman, Bob's favorite dive location. And I'll bet you want to make sure that your dive computer and everything that controls the BC and everything like that was built to harsh environments, right?
Well, yes, but I like to be old school as well. I have a watch, and I have a gauge that tells me how much air I've got, and I apply as much common sense as I possibly can.
And that's why you're still with us. Well, and we're glad you're still with us. How do people get a hold of you, Bob?
Well, they can visit the website, which is bobwillis.co.uk. The email is there, so all the information is there. So that's really the best way to contact me.
Excellent. Bob, thank you so much. It's been very enjoyable speaking with you, as always. And thanks so much. I'm very grateful that you're my first guest on this debut episode of Reliability Matters. Thanks for your time, and have a great rest of the evening.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
My pleasure. Well, we did it. One down, 23 more podcasts to go this year. We've got a great lineup of guests with interesting experiences and points of view. I hope you found this podcast useful. If you liked what you heard, give us a like. If you have any comments, including suggested topics, please click on the comment link or shoot me an email at mike@mikeconrad.com. That's Conrad with a K. Thanks again so much for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode of Reliability Matters.
Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Join us on the second and fourth Tuesday of each month for new episodes of Reliability Matters.